everybody. Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin. With me, my co-host from Stratford on Avon, Mr. Barry Rose. They call him the gentleman. Barry, how you doing?
I'm doing good, man. This is an early morning show for us, Jeff. We usually record middle of the night, and this is one where we got up at the crack of dawn, and we're recording right after Thanksgiving. Jeff, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was a relatively quiet Thanksgiving, as Mr. and Mrs. Bowdrin were home alone as the chillin' are in Georgia. So it was just the wife, myself, the two dogs, and we allow the cat to live here. So on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on Thanksgiving. We're going to break kayfabe on sports. I said cave. We're going to break kayfabe. Thank you, Brian. On sports, movies, television, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. So on today's show, we are going to be going to keep it current today, folks. We're going to keep it by looking at some matches that have happened within the last month, dare I say. Including, we are going to be taking a look of a match that happened in Dublin, Ireland. First time ever, Barry, we're going to take a look at a match that happened in Ireland. Ah, the Emerald Isle. As Will Ospreay takes on Walter. Along with that, we're going to be taking a look at the recent Survivor Series, the NXT show. And we are going to be offering up our choices for the top five Michael Douglas films. Barry, we are loaded for bear and ready to go. You ready to head out with me, my friend?
I'm ready to do this, too. What are we starting off with today?
We are going to start off, first of all, how about the shout-out from Kevin Kelly on Twitter, after I basically prodded him, saying that he listens to our show, Barry.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So he is a super guy, and he is somebody, years ago when I was doing the old CWF Archives website, Kevin Kelly was one of the first guys that reached out, and we used to have a guest book, and he actually went on, and I think he was working for the WWF or WWE at that point as well, and he went on and he actually left a comment, and I never knew, but he grew up in Florida watching CWF, and then I got to meet Kevin Kelly 2 years ago with Eric Chulminski. Our good friend Eric Chulminski, we were at a show, I think it was an ROH show, obviously would have been an ROH show, and Kevin Kelly always acknowledged Eric, and I think it was he was a big Phillies fan. So he's a real approachable guy, and when I saw that, you texted me, and then I took a look. I was like, that's pretty cool, but that's him in a nutshell, too. If he likes what you're doing, he's going to reach out, and he's going to tell you that.
And you know what he said, surprisingly, in a private message? He says he likes our show better than 605, but going to keep that between me and Brian last. Little competition going on. Okay, Barry, now it's time for us to discuss the recent big weekend for the WWE Survivor Series NXT. I know you are a huge fan for the pay-per-views that involve the NXT stuff. So before we start talking about the NXT, though, let's talk about what really was the big deal at the Survivor Series. And that is the Ronda Rousey, Charlotte Flair angle. Barry, I had a chance to look at it. So did you. Tell me what you thought of that big angle.
I was blown away. And, you know, to me, the Survivor Series really came down to four matches and maybe even came down to two matches. But the big takeaway for me was Charlotte Flair. And Charlotte Flair is one, she's very, very polarizing for some reason. And she's certainly, there's a lot of people who don't like her, whether they perceive that she got her push based off of who her father is, which I'm sure helped, obviously. You know, we can be honest about that. But at the same time, she's extremely athletic. She does stuff that I don't think I've seen a lot of other women do in this country. And a lot of her matches are believable. And you've pointed out privately to me that you feel at times she's sloppy. And look, she might be a little sloppy. I'm not really sure if she is or not. But at the same time, when I see her, the quality of her matches to me are believable. And there's a certain stiffness to it, which I really like as well. So she had a match with Ronda Rousey. Ronda is limited in what she can do in the ring, but it's usually disguised pretty well between her gimmick and working with somebody like Charlotte Flair. The match was okay. However, the beatdown was, in my opinion, one of the great beatdowns in the history of professional wrestling. And I think that really says a lot too, Jeff. And Charlotte Flair laid into her with these kendo sticks. Ronda Rousey was bleeding from her mouth. There's actually a pool of blood outside the ring at one point that you could see, which I believe was Ronda spitting out the blood, which came from her mouth. She had a cut on her ear. She has a nice cauliflower ear, too. Did you happen to see that?
I did not see that. That's nice.
Yeah, I never realized that before, but they were showing, she took some shot right near her ear, and she has this big old cauliflower ear. And according to Ron Fuller, who we've listened to on the Studcast, cauliflower ears are extremely painful to get. It's a badge of honor for a lot of old-time wrestlers, but extremely painful. But Ronda was beaten with this kendo stick and just anything and everything and just destroyed. And the cuts, the welts, the bruises all over her body, between her arms and her legs, her head. It was, Jeff, a beatdown that that, dare I say, I haven't seen a lot of men take. I don't think I've ever seen a female ever take this kind of beat down before. But what it did, really, it solidified two things for me. One was, hey, it stole the show, first off, which I thought was great. But it said to me that, hey, Charlotte Flair is back, because she is definitely, as a baby face, she definitely kind of flounders a little bit. Fans don't really take to her the same. As a psycho heel, I thought she was fantastic, but Ronda Rousey, it took abuse. I mean, this was serious abuse. And so this is, to me, that says something too, because obviously she didn't go into this without giving the full okay that she was going to get her ass beat. And that's a real dedication as far as your craft, because I'm not sure, you know, look, obviously I'm not a professional wrestler, neither of us are, Jeff. But at the same time, I'm not quite sure that I would have gone into any situation like that knowingly going to get my ass beat like that. So that shows a real dedication to what she's actually doing. So I was blown away by it. And I remember texting my son right after and saying, you know, my son, who was doing like college essays, like, you may want to get down here and just see what just happened. So I thought it was great. The rest of the card, you know, it was the rest of the card. There was some other good stuff there, but this was by far the highlight. And this was something, in my opinion, I think, I'm going to quote the WWE universe on this one. They should be talking about this for weeks to come.
Yeah, you know, as I watched it, I do have my my own personal complaints with Charlotte Flair and some of what I think of her limitations in the ring. But what the WWE does do a good job of is covering up her limitations and, quite frankly, Ronda Rousey's limitations as a professional wrestler. You know, and then again, the fact that Ronda Rousey, whether you like her a lot of people don't like her, especially based on the reaction she got after the beatdown, you know, she has a history of legitimate fighting, and that she would agree that to do this really says a lot for her and her, her desire to really, fully embrace the WWE universe. And I think she needs to get a lot of credit for allowing herself, as you said, to be put in this position. I think Charlotte Flair did a great job of playing the crazy over the top heel. I think, you know, as I sit there and listen to you talk about how this was such a crazy looking thing, I think it's a crazy looking thing in the context of the wrestling world we live in now. You know, was this a crazy thing compared to like some stuff that ECW or Smoky Mountain or Memphis did? No, not really. But for the wrestling world that we now live in, yeah, it came off as definitely something that was out there, something that you don't see all the time. Now, that being said, while I love the angle, I actually preferred the match between Kairi Sane and Shayna Baszler that was on the NXT. I thought that was a better match. Now, when I had a chance to look at the old Meltz scale there in the Observer, he liked the Charlotte Flair match better. I don't know whether he was doing that as part of the match and the angle itself afterwards. I'm not sure, but I actually like the NXT women's match better. Barry, what did you think?
Well, first off, whatever Dave Meltzer says, more power to him. It's one guy.
No, absolutely. I understand.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, look, he may like pineapple on his pizza, where I would flush that shit right down the fucking toilet. So
he may like Sting.
He may like Sting. You never know. But yeah, so I don't. I'm going to say it, Jeff. Quote me on this. You're 100% right. That Kairi Sane, Shayna Baszler match was fantastic. What made the Ronda Rousey Charlotte Flair match was the beatdown. The match was the match. And there's, you know, look, had that beatdown not occurred, we would have said, okay, that was good. You know, I would have said that. You would not have said that. But it was the beatdown, which is of epic, epic proportions. Just to touch on Survivor Series, and then let's move on to NXT, which was a million times better, and I'll rave about that like I do every 3 months after a show takes place. the best four matches of the night, obviously Flair and Ronda Rousey. Shinsuke Nakamura, Seth Rollins. Good match, not as good as it should have been. Shinsuke is, you know, he's not the same guy. He, coming over, working in the WWE, having to pull back a little bit, which is odd considering what we saw Charlotte Flair do. But, you know, it was a good match. I don't know. There's something missing in Shinsuke's matches right now. Brock Lesnar, Daniel Bryan. I'll tell you what I thought was very, very smart about this match. Did you watch the entire match or just the highlights?
No, I just saw the highlights.
Yeah, so it was the initial was and it was interesting as well, because Daniel Bryan, who was a full fledged heel at this point, really was kind of playing the underdog role here. I don't know if he was a babyface. I would assume he was, but it was he was playing the underdog role. But he was destroyed for the first give or take 10 minutes of the match, to the point that the announcers were saying the referee should stop the match. And there was zero offense coming at this point. Brock was just destroying him. Daniel Bryan doing a great job of selling with his glazed look in his eyes. And then he gets lucky with a couple of kicks to the head. Then he's doing knees to the head. And they pulled it off where you believe Daniel Bryan was going to actually beat him. And I think they missed the boat. I think they should have had Daniel Bryan beat him, Lesnar, but they didn't do it. But it was a really good match, and I think it was booked well. I think that was the shock of it. However, there was a real surprise on this card, and it was a surprise? Only to people that aren't paying attention. Mustafa Ali versus Buddy Murphy for the Cruiserweight title, probably the best pure match of the show. And it was absolutely incredible. Buddy Murphy, who was part of a tag team in NXT, which was Blake and Murphy. I think the other guy knocked up one of the winners of Tough Enough, and he's like disappeared, or he's in a tag team now as well. But this Buddy Murphy really has a chance to shine as the Cruiserweight champion right now. And Mustafa Ali is a, you know, just these two guys put on a show. And it wasn't just all, and I hate to use this term, flippy floppy shit, because it wasn't. There was mat wrestling, there was some brawling, there was some innovative flying maneuvers, but I thought that was the match of the night as a pure match. However, getting back, and that's a very long-winded response, Jeff, and I apologize to you and our multitude of listeners, but the card the night before just blew it away. And I say that, you say that, and I think everybody that watches NXT TakeOver for the most part says the NXT TakeOvers blow away the WWE pay-per-views. And part of it is they had five matches that night, and one of those matches, in my opinion, doesn't even count. So really they had four matches. So they don't overload the card with, eight or nine matches. They've got four matches in two and a half hours, whatever the time length is. And every match is good. Every match is solid. So I really enjoyed it. So we'll talk about it. First match was Matt Riddle versus Cassius Ohno. Wasn't even a match. It was a knee strike, and Matt Riddle goes over. Cassius Ohno obviously is there to help get Riddle over. And have you had a chance to see Riddle, Jeff?
I don't think I have. I may have seen a couple highlights of his matches, but as you know, we've discussed before, not huge on the product, except for the pay-per-views. And I know he just came to NXT, correct?
He did. He just came, you know, maybe a month. He's only had, I think, one or two matches. So he's got a really interesting gimmick, and it's definitely a polarizing gimmick. He does kind of a, and let's go ahead and date myself right here, a Louis Spicoli, Jeff Spicoli, and I'm referencing Louis Spicoli, God rest his soul, but he's doing a Jeff Spicoli kind of stoner gimmick, which is interesting because he's an MMA fighter. He's in amazing shape. He's literally can do some amazing strikes, but his whole gimmick is bro. And he calls everybody bro. And we're known as the brothership, the two best friends you never knew you had. But he's doing this real stoner kind of gimmick. And he smiles a lot. And then when the matches start, he gets serious, you know, et cetera. But to me, it's a polarizing kind of gimmick. I think there's a point coming where initially it'll get him over, and then I could see fans getting tired of it and turning him heel. And that's where I would imagine this is going to go. He certainly can do anything in the ring. For a guy that's been wrestling for just a few years at this point, he seems like he's got a lot down. But yeah, I guess it's hard for me to listen to his interviews, which come across like a guy who's really high, which he may be, and just a lot of bros being tossed out. The match you referenced, Shayna Baszler versus Kairi Sane, it blew away the match the next night. This was a match. Shayna Baszler, and I've said this numerous times, and I say this to anybody that asks me, or even if they don't ask me, I force feed this opinion down their throats. Shayna Baszler is one of these people that has it in quotation marks, and it doesn't happen that often. We've talked about Dick Slater. Dick Slater, right out of the gate, some 46 years ago, was good in like his first or second match. It just happened. He had it. Kurt Angle was good right from the get-go. Certain people have it. Shayna Baszler has it. She has not been wrestling for too long. She completely understands the psychology of how to get fans to turn against her and dislike her, and her matches are good. Kairi Sane, come on. She is unbelievable. She is everything that I'm assuming that people wanted Asuka to be. And for whatever the reason is, it's a different style. They're not exactly the same style. But Kairi Sane, to me, is absolutely incredible. I'm a little mixed on the pirate gimmick. I know some of our listeners love the pirate gimmick. I forget who I was talking to, and I don't want to get in trouble for this, but I forget who I was talking to. And
you can't remember the name, there's going to be a problem, Barry.
I can't remember the name. And
we are a professional, well-paid podcast. We earn top dollar for this fucking show.
Let's be honest. I'm not professional by any stretch, and I'm paid somewhere kind of around the level of mediocrity. But at the same time, I believe we were having this conversation with somebody. You know what, Jeff? Just remembered. We were talking at your wedding. I can't believe I actually do remember this. We were talking at your daughter's wedding. And it was the young man named Anthony, who's also a professional wrestler. His fiance or girlfriend is a huge wrestling fan, and she loves the Kairi Sane pirate gimmick. And I don't remember her name, but I remember who she was. And I'm somewhere mixed on the pirate gimmick. I don't see the pirate gimmick really making it on the main stage. But as a wrestler, Kairi Sane is aces. She is fantastic. This was a great match, start to finish. I loved it. These two could fight. You know, I don't want to say fight forever. I hate that. But at the same time, I could watch a feud between these two ladies for the next 6 months because you know you're going to get quality matches. Aleister Black versus Johnny Gargano. Really good match. A little slower to build. And then once it did Aleister Black to me is a guy that when he makes it to the main stage, you're going to be able to print money from him. And I would not bring him in as a baby face. I would definitely bring him in as a heel. I love the gimmick. He can do a lot. I like his unique style, which is a very striking style. Gargano is, you know, he needed to win on this one, as I actually watched this match with my son. My son points out that Gargano loses. I think he's won one match on an NXT TakeOver, and he's lost pretty much every other match, and we are going, oh, yeah, he's definitely going to get the win on this one. Didn't happen. He wound up doing the job again. Solid guy. I don't understand that. Ciampa versus Velveteen Dream. Very good match. Velveteen Dream, he's the darling. He is the guy that the NXT universe loves. He is the guy that a lot of superstars for the WWE, guys like John Cena and a whole bunch of others, are predicting is the future of wrestling. He is. The guy has got it. I wouldn't pull the trigger on him yet. I would definitely wait a little bit, but solid. Solid as the day is long. I think my worry is I see a future in Velveteen Dream, and I think if you rush him right now, you're going to fuck that up. And Ciampa, I've said it before, Ciampa to me is maybe the best heel in America currently as far as wrestling. He's just incredible. And War Games. So, Jeff, did you watch the entire match, or did you just see the highlights?
I did, and I have my thoughts on it, so I'll let you continue.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I'm going to say some controversial shit right now, and I'm going to do it, but I thought this match was incredible. And the War Games they did last year I thought was great. Did you see the one last year that took place?
I don't believe I did, no.
Gotcha. This guy from Sanity, Alexander Wolf, I think he went through a table. I forget exactly what the spot was, but he busted open his head and he was bleeding buckets, and he just laid on the match for something like 20 minutes with a referee who was trying to stop the bleeding. I don't recall them actually taking him out of the ring, but it was just a train wreck, and it just looked like a painful match. I thought this match was great, and I thought this match offered everything that you would want in a War Games. I thought the booking was good. I thought the match was laid out. It would be very hard for me, unless you're going to point out flaws that possibly I will agree with. Just coming to mind, I don't see any flaws to it. I will say, and I was having this conversation with somebody online the other day, that they said, yeah, you know, it's good, but the War Games in the old days with Dusty and Luger and Nikita were so much better. And no, they weren't. Sorry. You know, look, you're talking to an old fart that was my generation. The two War Games matches we've seen over the last 2 years blow away any of the War Games that took place 30 and 35 years ago. I think it's great. If you want to wax nostalgically about shit that happened in previously, and I'll be the first one to tell you, I find a lot of fault with whatever takes place currently. These War Games, I think I preferred last year's a little bit better, but these two War Games to me have just been off the charts on so many different levels. I really enjoyed it, and I got to say, when these NXT takeovers are over, I'm like a 12-year-old girl just jumping up and down, because it's these takeovers that remind me why I'm a wrestling fan. I put up with Raw every Monday night for 3 hours. I generally take a 60 to 90-minute nap because it's so boring and it's just tedious. But these takeovers remind me this is why I like professional wrestling. And I get all gushy about it. I'm like, you know, I've been watching wrestling for over 4 decades. When I see a card like this with the effort put in by everybody from start to finish, I'm so grateful. This is why I like being a fan.
I just want all the listeners at this point to take a moment to stop, to close your eyes. Please, just bear with me, folks. Close your eyes for about 2 or 3 seconds and think of yourself, the 13-year-old, 12-year-old, girlish Berry Rose. And we're done. Okay, so now... That was a little bit troubling, quite frankly, Barry.
Very troubling. Actually,
I will offer my thoughts. My only complaint about the match, it was a very good match. You're absolutely right. But the match went, what are we talking, 45, 46, 47 minutes?
Yep.
And it seemed like it was about 40 to 45 minutes of kill shots. And my complaint is not with this match itself. It's with wrestling in general now. There are so many times where there's a move that, let's be honest, 30 years ago would have been the finish for a match. And I understand wrestling has evolved and it's a different sport than it was when Barry and I first started watching it. We are the old farts, breaking kayfabe with the old farts. That's what we should change the name of our show to, Barry. But, you know, there's just so much that, you know, at some point you're like, oh, okay, come on. The guy, you know, was just destroyed and he gets up, you know, he doesn't even let the thing be a 2.5 count. He kicks out at 1. And that's my only, you know, negative note on the match itself is that just, and like I said, this happens in New Japan. It happens probably in a match that we're going to discuss a little bit later, but that's my only complaint. And that's more of a wrestling thing now more than it is a WWE thing. It was a really, really good match. I really enjoyed it. Lots of strong stuff, some amazing performances in there, and Ricochet doing some crazy, crazy spots. But a really, really good match, Barry.
Yeah, really, really good, too. And, you know, Pete Dunne, I am such a fan of Pete Dunne. And I know he wrestles for that promotion that you mentioned earlier, the one over in Ireland, which I think is called Over the Top, OTT.
It's OTT, yes.
Yeah, so I'm a huge Pete Dunne fan. And I think a lot of people that see him, you know, are big fans of him. I felt the match was laid out well. I think that's what I like. There were some crazy spots. I love the ending. As much as I would have loved to have seen Undisputed Era win, I think that would have been cool. Had they won, and then they won 2 years in a row, and then next year they come back, and even if they're on the main roster, they would come back and do war games every year, Undisputed Era. I think that would have been cool if you start some sort of streak like that. But that's obviously, that's just me, you know, playing armchair booker, which is your job. I shouldn't be attempting this, but I thought it was great. You know, and I'm such a huge Roderick Strong. Adam Cole, I was 100% wrong. When I saw Adam Cole at ROH shows, I was like, yeah, he's good here. He'll never get over in the WWE. I'm 100% wrong, and I'll be the first one to tell you. This guy is over as could be. Roderick Strong, I think, is one of the best wrestlers currently in the U.S. and has been for the last 3 or 4 years. Huge fan. Kyle O'Reilly, you know, Bobby Fish, I think these guys are great. So I love this NXT TakeOver. I could sit here again like a 12-year-old schoolgirl and gush for the next 90 minutes, but nobody wants to hear that. But I'm going to start a calendar so I can start checking off, much like you are, Jeff, when it comes to your retirement, and you know exactly how many days until you retire. I want to know exactly how many days until the next NXT TakeOver.
Well, my figure is 570 days, Barry, 2 years, wow. 2 months, 5 days. Not that I'm counting. I have the calendar on my phone. Now, sure. Let's talk about something I saw online the other day that gave us a little flashback to the old CWF glory days, Barry. And I mentioned it to you, the angle where Kendo Nagasaki, the dreaded Black Ninja, Barry, this was about 1982, attacked Eddie Graham. And gave him the old, I don't know, the Vulcan nerve grip or something like that. But Eddie begins spitting up blood. And it was such a well-done angle. And it was great because you had that rare occasion where Gordon Solie left the announcer's desk and got in the ambulance with his good friend Eddie Graham. Barry, tell us what you remember about that angle from Florida.
Yeah, boy, is this a good angle, too. And you could not be able to pull anything like this off today, at least on as far as the major promotions. You know, I think possibly in Japan you could do this. This OTT promotion in Ireland, you could probably do it, but it wouldn't work in the U.S. But this was in 1982. Now, we had seen Kendo Nagasaki twice before. He was Mr. Sakuruda, who was part of a tag team with Mr. Hito 3 years earlier. And then he came back really just a few months from this. He was Chan Chung, which was a masked professional wrestler. He was a masked Asian professional wrestler. So Kendo Nagasaki was kind of an unknown commodity, and he had never gotten that main event push. So he was a guy who was part of a tag team, and then he was a mid-card, maybe a little upper mid-card, but it didn't work. So Kendo was it. Kendo was obviously taken from Kabuki. Kabuki had been around for a year or two earlier, and it was an attempt to push Kendo right to the top. And quite frankly, it was this angle which actually got him up to the top, because he became a believable main event heel in the state of Florida based off of this angle. So you're right. He attacked Eddie Graham, who had been retired for a year or two prior to this. And he attacked Eddie and just laid him out. And Eddie was injured. And what was great about this angle, on so many different levels, having Gordon, again, Jeff, you're 100% right. We got to get that on a T-shirt. But having Gordon get into the ambulance with him was money. The fact that the camera follows the ambulance outside, so you're getting to see the glamorous alleyway next to the Tampa Sportatore, which really, if you've ever been there, Jeff, you know, it's not really glamorous. I got to say, so when I was there last month, I went to the Sportatorium, and I went down that alleyway, and I tried to get in that building, and as we know, that building is now again for sale, but I tried to get in that building any which way I could, and I couldn't. Everywhere, every door was locked, every window was bolted, but that alleyway is, it's not a glamorous alleyway by any means, but I like the fact that the camera's out there, it's filming all this, and then we've got Bruce Tharp, who was kind of a jack of all trades at this point for CWF, and he was doing ring announcing. He did some announcing for television. He was doing referee work. Bruce Tharp actually takes over for Gordon, and he sells it like $1 million. I mean, Bruce, if you're listening, and I don't know if Bruce does listen to our show, But at the same time, he sold this like no one's business. I thought that was great. This is, and again, you can't do angles like this, but this is one of those angles that worked. And you touched on it. The reason I think it worked so well, Eddie was great because Eddie was dead. Eddie wasn't moving. Eddie was just dead. But having Gordon leave the announcer's desk to ride in the ambulance, and then what is the ambulance? The EMT guy, what does he say?
He says, does he have any significant medical history? Which is just awesome.
And it's great because he's asking television job guys, yeah. First off.
And then you have Brian Blair said, well, he caught him in the throat with that karate.
Right. And Eddie did have a very significant medical history at this point, going back some. Yeah, exactly. He did. So I don't know if anybody was starting to rattle off what happened, at the Fort Homer Hesterly Armory in 67 when the window pane fell on him. Yeah, exactly. I don't know who's mentioning it, but maybe some of these guys were carrying around Eddie's medical records. I don't know. But to me, genius. Genius booking, very effective, worked, got Kendo over. And I think it said that, you know what, we're going to give Kendo the ball here and see what happens. For Eddie to do this angle, that instills a lot of confidence in Kendo Nagasaki at this point. He was an unknown commodity. And when you sent this to me, I watched it. I think I waited 2 minutes. I went back and I watched it again because I enjoyed it so much. This is 4 stars to me right there.
Yeah, there's just so many different layers of why this is a great angle. Eddie, blood coming from the mouth, and Gordon, he's hemorrhaging. And then, the ambulance driver with the, does he have any significant medical history? Brian Blair and Barry Windham was out there too. I can't remember what Barry said. Yeah. Barry said something like, hey, he's a ninja, or I don't know, something funny.
He's a ninja.
But yeah, it's just, And one of the things you said was he got this from Greg Kabuki, who of course had been in Texas and in Georgia. However, Barry, I don't know if you recall, before even the Great Kabuki, there was a Great Kabuki in the Detroit area in the early 70s.
Was Ray Urbano.
Ray Urbano, yes, I was going
to
say that.
Goes back to the 60s, and it was a different type of gimmick, because Ray Urbano had been a guy, but he was just Filipino, if I'm correct. He was a guy that had been a wrestler going back to the 50s, and he was a prelim guy, and they gave him this gimmick, which really, I think, extended his career, which I think was the reasoning for it. And he wound up working in his old age, and I say that, he wound up working for Poffo ICW in the early 80s. And he couldn't have been a young guy at that point. But yeah, when we say Kabuki, I think he actually spelled it different.
Yeah, with
K-A-B-O-O-K-I,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But we always think of, the guy who was Mr. Sato, Akahisa Mera, as the Great Kabuki. But yeah, what a cool gimmick, man.
Absolutely. So, Barry, do you know what time it is, my friend?
We just talked about the state of Florida and this glamorous alleyway. So I'm going to assume it's my favorite time of the week, Jeff, and it's the week that I always look forward to hearing these stories, because I think my batting average, I'm somewhere around like 34% at this point. So, yeah. So bring
As we uncovered last week, my batting average may have been enhanced. I may have been using the Barry Bonds-esque enhancement to buffer my score, but all was revealed at the end of the show. Barry, first story we got here. Construction workers found quite the surprise when they were renovating a building. City officials were told that when crews knocked down a wall in the building, Barry, nearly 1,000 human teeth came spilling out. Well, there's no clear explanation. Officials say the building had been standing since 1900 and apparently was the home to a dentist for several decades. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
And that's interesting, too, because if you're keeping teeth and you're not a dentist, then you're like a serial killer. You'd have to be. It doesn't make it right that it's a dentist. It makes it a little more palatable. It's a dentist. Palatable, if you catch the pun on that. But is it Florida? I'm going to say, I mean, Florida, there are a lot of toothless people in Florida. I'm going to say it's Florida, and I'm going to say that a lot of the toothless people, it's Florida. It's definitely Florida.
Valdosta, Georgia. 0 for 1.
0-1. Have you ever been to Valdosta, Jeff? You know about Georgia a lot. You want to move to Georgia.
Yeah, not to Valdosta.
So. All right. A lot of toothless people running around Valdosta. That's interesting, though. Yes. Oh, 1,000 feet, huh?
Next story. Woman sues Samsung for $1.8 million after cell phone gets stuck in her vajayjay. A woman is suing Samsung after she necessitated medical attention after inserting her cell phone in the vajayjay and was unable to retrieve it, Barry, get this, for 96 hours. Selma Bryant claims her medical bills at the hospital amount to over $1 million. Actually, it's $1.1 million. She suffered severe psychological distress, I'll bet, because of the whole idea. She said she inserted the cell phone into the vajayjay on a dare from one of her friends, but quickly realized, because, of course, who wouldn't do that on a dare, Barry?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Barry, Florida or not. And this is a good headline.
That's a great headline, too. And Is she suing Samsung, or is there a verdict on this yet? I can't see her winning this.
I think the suit was just filed recently.
Okay. I mean, I can't see her. So on a dare, she's inserting so it's a Samsung, which
okay,
is
here's
Android.
The story. Basically, from what, as I read the story, basically, she
are there any
wanted
photos?
I don't know if there's any internal photos, but okay. I think basically she wanted to see the difference between having the cell phone in the vajayjay and what's called the old pocket rocket in the vajayjay, if you get my drift, and I think you do.
So she wanted to put the cell phone in her vagina and then have somebody call it so
exactly.
It vibrates?
Exactly.
Gotcha. Well, you know what, Jeff, I don't know about you, but I never had friends like this growing up. So that right there tells me that, you know, I was hanging out with the wrong crowds.
Well, we established that long ago, Barry, but anyway.
We didn't have cell phones back in those days, sadly, but that's really interesting. Is this Florida or not Florida? Is she attractive by any chance? Was there a photo of her?
I, of course, being married, will offer no commentary.
All right. I'm going to say...
But any port in a storm, you know, that kind of thing, Barry.
All right. Yeah, yeah. That's a lot of money, too, I'm going to say this was not Florida, which is really known as an Apple state, not an Android state. That's my rationale for this. So I'm going to say it's not Florida.
Albuquerque, New Mexico, my friend.
Which is an Android state. Exactly. That makes a lot of sense now.
So anyway... All right, next headline, Barry. Woman reportedly killed boyfriend, made traditional dish using his remains. Oh, Barry. A Moroccan woman is accused of killing her boyfriend, then cooking and serving his remains in a traditional homemade dish. The woman, whose identity wasn't released, well, thank God for that, allegedly wanted revenge because her boyfriend dumped her after she had financially supported him over the course of their 7-year relationship. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
You said she's Moroccan by origin.
It's a Moroccan descent. That's true.
Yeah, that'll get you in trouble right there. I knew a Moroccan girl. You'll get your ass kicked. I am going to say. So I was born and raised in Florida. I don't recall any large communities of Moroccans living in Florida. There was Don Morocco, but
that's
different. Yeah, I'm going to say
think she's from Morocco though.
But there was that period where he was spelling it unusual after he turned heel as well. I'm going to say this was not Florida.
Barry, not only was this not Florida, it was not the United States. It's the UAR, the United Arab Emirates. So here's the even more grisly story about this, Barry. Barry, she kept the body for 3 months, but she wasn't arrested until, quote, a tooth was found in her blender. Yikes.
A tooth in the blender. And the dentist in Valdosta is really pissed off about that right now.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So, okay, Barry, next story here. Hold on, got to pull it up. 73-year-old woman asked doctors to test her meth. A 73-year-old woman asked her doctors to check her methamphetamine supply to determine whether it was really the drug she was smoking. she was complaining about the meth, Barry. Florida or not Florida?
Sure. That's it. If you ever have a problem with your drugs, you go right to your doctor. Don't they have a kit for this? Can't you go to Walmart to get a kit to test your drugs?
I'm not sure if this is covered under Obamacare. I'm just asking.
This is not that. This is a Florida story. That right there, the stupidity of that makes that a Florida story. You sure?
Polk County, Florida, Barry. You are correct, my friend.
I am four. I'm three for four, right?
You're doing well, my friend. Okay,
it's the best week I've ever had.
Last story, Barry. Let's see how you do as you close it out. The headline: strip club closed after food stamps accepted for lap dances and drugs. A strip club bit off more than they could chew after losing its liquor license following an investigation that proved it allowed customers to use food stamps to buy lap dances and drugs. Boy, is that convenience or what, Barry? You know, I'd like to have Misty there on the big stage, and here's a couple of food stamps, Barry.
If Misty's willing to accept those food stamps, sure, why not, right? So this... I'm tempted to say Florida, because this is easily a story that could have taken place in Florida. Conventional logic, you just had a story about Florida. Are you switching it up on me? Where do I go? On the basis, on the surface, this is absolutely a story that could have taken place in Florida. I'm going to say Florida just based on that.
3 for 5, my friend. Ohio! Boom! Ohio. Lose. But still 3 for 5. That's a 600 average. We're very impressed. Watch out for those strip clubs in Ohio, apparently. So Barry, now it is time for our discussion on a match. And hey, folks, we're not going to the 70s, not to the 80s. We are going right to last month, October 14th of this year. We're going to Dublin, Ireland, the Emerald Isle, and a match recommended by Dave Melcher. Just want to give the person that recommended something credit, Barry, because sometimes we don't do that, I hear. We are talking Will Ospreay versus Walter. And, you know, you mentioned that you think Ciampa is the best heel in the U.S. Barry, I'm telling you, he is great. But right now, is there a better heel working in this business than Walter? That guy is incredible.
Walter is pretty cool, too. And Walter is a guy, you said this to me either in a phone call, I think it was a phone call last week, that he's got kind of this Waldo Von Erich kind of thing going. Not a Nazi gimmick by any means, but he does. And when he stands there and he puts his arms behind his back, he does. He has a great aura about him. And I think, could he get over in the U.S.? Yeah, he could. I would hate to see him go to the WWE, because they'd wind up putting, you know, a clown wig on him or some shit. It would completely kill it. What he's doing, though, over in Europe is pretty cool. So this is a very, very good match. And this is one of these matches. You sent me the link, and I was able to put it on my smart TV on a big screen. And it's a solid 30-minute match. And I really, really enjoyed it, too. So I'll give you some notes of what I wrote. The venue is super cool. And this is a passionate crowd. The crowd is allowed to come up to the ring. They can actually bang on the ring. They call it the war drums. So they really involve the fans. And they've embraced the fans. They take the fans in. There's a similarity to ROH, a similarity to the old ECW. This is a rabid fan base. I love the venue. It's a small venue. Walter is, I wrote this down, one of the announcers called him this, and I think you would agree, Walter is a stone-cold killing machine, Jeff. And he, you know, his aura is the shit that either you get it or you don't get it. You can't teach this kind of thing. He's got it. By looking at him, he's got this aura about him. And this match is a good match. What I liked about this match, it's a slow burn on it. There's a slow build-up to it. It doesn't, you know, Ospreay is a guy, he's arguably maybe the most exciting professional wrestler out there. And we'll definitely talk about that as we progress with our notes and stuff. But, you know, the high spots he does, his flips, there's nobody else that can do what Ospreay does. I don't care who you are. You know, Ricochet is very exciting, but Will Ospreay, to me, as far as this style of wrestling, has cornered the market, because he's absolutely incredible. So what was smart about this match was they didn't go right for the flips and the somersaults and all that. They actually had a match, and then they built up, and then towards the end, the second half of the match is when Ospreay really unloads. Walter's chops. So we've talked about, and I want to take out Flair. Wahoo had some pretty serious chops. Kenta Kobashi has some serious chops. Walter's chops, though, Jeff, you get the feeling like if Walter chopped you, you'd wind up in the hospital. Like, it is frightening. And they were chopping the shit out of each other. And Ospreay was chopping back, but there's one part where Ospreay is coming to, and he's doing a flip off the ropes, and Walter just catches him his back with a chop, and Ospreay goes down like he just got shot. It just looked painful, but they were chopping each other. I believe both their chests were bloody. And we had also talked about this off air, but Ospreay and Walter both came into the match with bruised scar tissue on their chests. So this is something that they're doing on a nightly basis. And unlike the old days where you had the foreheads of guys like Dusty and King Curtis and Joe LaDuke, it seems like the new scar tissue now is the chest. And that'll be interesting to see as things progress. I guess it's better to have it on your chest than your forehead. Ospreay, super over with the crowd. As Walter is over as a heel, Ospreay is over as a babyface. And we're talking there, both these guys are super, super over. There's a false finish where it looks like Walter pins Ospreay, but Ospreay got his foot on the ropes and the referee started the match. And at that point, I'm thinking, okay, we're going to see a title change. Apparently, Walter's had this title. He's undefeated in this promotion. This promotion just celebrated their four-year anniversary. So I don't know how long Walter's been there, but apparently he's never lost a match. And I thought this was going to be it, because I thought with this false finish, as over as Ospreay is and his offense, okay, he's winning the title. Walter does a power bomb off the top rope onto Ospreay, and I thought he was going to go through the mat with him. I thought it was going to be one of these where, okay, Ospreay's dead, it's over. But a couple of takeaways from this match. Ospreay's offense, it's unique, and granted, there's a lot of guys who fly, but there's nobody doing what Will Ospreay's doing. And it's, I don't know how you teach this. I don't know how you learn this. It's nothing short of breathtaking. At the same time, how old is Will Ospreay? Is he like 22 or 23 years old, Jeff?
I'm going to check while you keep talking. Right? You keep talking, and I'm going to check.
Okay. He's a young guy. He's a young guy. And when you watch a match like this with the amount of abuse that he's taking and then the amount of abuse that he's doing to himself, his career, I just can't see it going.
25.
And he's 25. Okay. So I actually had him as even younger. But, you look at the WWE and you've got Paige, female wrestler whose career is over. The WWE will not let her wrestle any longer. There's conflicting reports that if she went somewhere else, she could be cleared. But the WWE is determined with her concussions that her career is over. There's a lot of speculation that Alexa Bliss, who has only been wrestling for a couple of years, that her career is now over based off of concussions. Daniel Bryan, who is back and very strong, took off 2 or 3 years because he was under the belief his career is over. So in wrestling a safer style in the U.S., which is what the WWE is, you are seeing careers that are shortened. Edge retired a few years back with neck injury, Stone Cold Steve Austin. So considered, quote-unquote, a safer style, yet guys still have to retire. Japan, Jeff, and we were just talking about this with the great Brian last off air, but the amount of guys in Japan over the last 2 or 3 years that have had to retire based off of injuries is staggering. And there is a report that came out that Takahashi may be done as well. A guy who kind of was cutting his teeth in Mexico, and then he came to ROH and then came back to Japan, and he got over that his career may now be over. So you look at the amount of guys in Japan that are at a young age having their careers completely ruined. And who's responsible for that? Is it the fans demanding it? Is it the promoters and the promotions for allowing it to go on? Is it the wrestlers themselves? Is it a combination of everybody involved? Possibly. But at the same time, you know, Shibata was one of my favorites. You know, and what I liked about Shibata was his hard-hitting style, which we now know ended his career. So, you know, a guy like Will Ospreay at 25, when I watch this, conceivably, how much longer can he do this for? Can he do, you know, this style that he's working? Another 2 to 3 years? Will he see 30 not in a wheelchair? I don't know.
Well, you see where the Dynamite Kid is at this point in his life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I fear for guys like for Will Ospreay, for guys like Ricochet, for guys like, you know, we mentioned Takahashi, that, you know, there's a fear. And based on his style, if he does come back, if he's able to make it back, is he going to be willing to change what made him so great? You know, Kushida does some crazy stuff in the rings, you know, and some of the headshots these guys are taking. And I don't just mean with, like, you know, chairs. I'm talking about where they're doing these moves where they're risking. You know, we talked about last week during the Kenta Kobashi Samoa Joe match, where Kobashi did like a snap suplex. And at the very last minute, you saw Joe, you know, move his head just ever so slightly, so he didn't take the full impact on the back of his neck. And, you know, these guys, sometimes they don't turn their head and they land, and you wonder, are we going to have a you know, Mitsuharu Misawa, where someone ends up dying in the ring, just passing out, and boom, they're dead because of the number of strikes and blows they take to their head. So it's a very valid question. I think this match was absolutely amazing, and it might have been one of the best matches I've seen all year. And, you know, Barry, one thing I will have to say, when you look back on the years over the, you know, over the course of the last 30 to 40 years, how many years were known as great years for great matches? You know, so often people remember 1989 because of the Flair Steamboat series, and the Flair Funk series. But, you know, and there, of course, there are other years also that were famous for having great matches. But in 2018, with all the great matches, you mentioned NXT, all the great matches in New Japan World. But wow, this match stands up with any of them. And I was so impressed. First of all, Barry, you didn't mention the promo video that leads to this match.
Yeah.
Is right up there with anything that WWE or New Japan World ever produced. And for a relatively smaller promotion based out of Dublin, Ireland to do this, I mean to tell you. So what they do is they start off and they're doing an interview with Will Ospreay, who's like, he's the hometown kid, and he's basically saying, Walter, you are going to have to kill me to defeat me, and you're going to have to leave me dead in the ring. Very strong stuff. And then the video splices in, and they show footage as they're introducing Walter, and it's very not so subtle, where they're doing, like, they're showing these troops marching. They're showing the effects of the bomb going off, or the palm trees are being pushed to the side, like when the bombs went off. When the A-bomb was being tested, that kind of stuff. And then they show you Walter and just how he's this force of nature. And, you know, you compare him to Waldo Von Erich. And I think in looks, he does look like Waldo Von Erich. But to me, his style is Fritz and Johnny Valentine. And that, by that, I mean that Walter, when he comes into the ring, he just has a way of looking at the fans and sneering at them that is so old school and so brilliant. And, you know, it's the classic Johnny Valentine line. I can't make you believe that wrestling is real, but I can make you, by God, believe that I'm real. And because he makes people think that he is real, this match, the way they're promoting it, has a very big fight feel. This promotion, OTT, Over the Top Wrestling, which apparently is based in Ireland, was just incredibly, incredibly impressive. He also, Walter, you know, I'm sitting here as you were talking, he also gives that vibe of a Brock Lesnar, of a, and I understand this is a different body type, but almost like a Minoru Suzuki, to where a guy that just looks like a killer. And that is, you know, I can't believe somebody in New Japan World doesn't know about this guy, because I would love to see a matchup with Walter going over to New Japan in one of the tournaments and, you know, meeting up with some of the, you know, Jeff Cobb or, oh my God, can you imagine him with Tomohiro Ishii, the Stone Cold Killer versus Walter?
Yeah.
Holy crap. What a match that would be. Just, you know, great, great stuff. Ospreay, of course, is doing all his moves. But what's great is, you know, we complain, Barry, about what you call flippy flop wrestlers. And Will Ospreay does all these spots and he's so great at them. But he's not a flippy flop wrestler because he's doing stuff during this match where he's, you know, showing that he's not just a high spot guy. He's really, really well trained. You mentioned the stiff chop to Ospreay's back where you think basically Ospreay's dead. Another great part about this match, especially because there's two guys that I never heard of, whoever the announcers were on this show, added so much to this match. And the crowd at ringside, they actually come up to the ring as the two guys are competing, and they're all slamming their hands on the ring. I've never seen a promotion that allowed fans to do that. It makes it really viscerally so much more interesting. The match, Ospreay hits the Shooting Star Press twice before he gets hit with the knee by Walter. There's a great line by one of the announcers. He says, "Will Ospreay does not live on Earth. He just visits Earth to wrestle," which I thought was a great line.
That's great.
They say that Ospreay is one of our own. And at a point where Walter hits a big move on Ospreay, the announcer says, and I thought this was a great line, he says, "Walter has just stolen the breath from 2,000 people here in the arena," which I thought was a great line. Match goes 26 minutes. Walter hits a big splash off the top rope, which comparatively speaking to some of the moves we saw did not look that impactful, but he gets the win. The crowd spontaneously begins chanting, "Thank you, Ospreay. Thank you, Ospreay." Wow. And his chest, as you said, looks like hamburger after this match, Barry, but what an incredible match. I cannot recommend this highly enough. Recommended in the Observer by Meltzer. And if you get a chance, we're going to post a link to it. This was a crazy, crazy good match, Barry.
Yeah, we should say, too, so this was a match that's offered by this promotion for free. I guess there is some sort of fees or monies that are involved, but this is one that they put up for free. So, you know, they obviously felt that this was a strong enough match. So when the link is posted, you definitely should be checking it out. I'd be curious to know, though, I already know your thoughts on this too, but I'd be curious to know, do you prefer this match over anything that you saw at NXT TakeOver?
Yes.
And because, yeah, and I know you do. I know that you do, but I'd be curious to what our listeners, so maybe that's some sort of question that we can put up in our Facebook group, because I'm not so sure that it blows away everything we saw at NXT TakeOver.
No, and it, you know, please don't make me, you know, misunderstood. There's nothing wrong with anything at NXT. NXT is top shelf, top of the line. My own personal opinion, I like this match. This match had more of an old school feel that I appreciate more than some of the stuff that was being done on the NXT show. That's just my own personal opinion.
Yeah, well, for a lot of it, too, that venue, I really, as you mentioned, people coming up to the ring and beating on that. And there's one point, too, when Walter's done and he's walking back to the dressing room, he pushes a fan right out of the way. Did you catch that?
Yeah. I mean,
he goes flying.
Very Terry Gordy-esque in the Sportatorium in Dallas. Remember that famous shot with?
I thought that was super cool. So to me, a lot of it is this venue. If I was, I don't see myself in Ireland anytime soon, but if I was in Ireland, I would seek this out because this is a place you'd want to go see professional wrestling in.
Absolutely. So Barry, before we go on, we want to thank once again our friend Ian Totten. His book, The House of Silver Doors, still available on Amazon. Ian coming through again as a sponsor for this show. We give a Breaking Kayfabe round of applause to Ian, and want to encourage all you fans to check out his book. We will post a link on our Facebook page of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry to Ian's book. And it's really good stuff, as I've said before, in the vein of a Stephen King, that kind of stuff, maybe Peter Straub. And I would encourage all you people that listen to the show to step up to the plate and to encourage and use our sponsors as they come along. We are certainly happy with Ian for his participation and helping to sponsor this show. Because, of course, we are so well paid that we have to know everyone's name, Barry, as they say. So, Barry, anything you want to say about Ian?
I was going to, Ian with the Balls of Steel Totten. Yeah, so we're extremely grateful for anybody that's actually purchased this book because it does. You know, this book, we exist on advertising. So Ian will always hold a place in the Advertising Hall of Fame for breaking kayfabe with Badger and Barry as our official first advertiser. I know that we've got somebody else lined up coming in the coming weeks, but anybody that has supported Ian by getting the book, and a bunch of our members have bought a copy of the book and then actually posted it in the Facebook group. It's so appreciated, and honestly, it speaks volumes about you to do something like that. And even the t-shirts, Jeff, we haven't sold a t-shirt in a while, have we?
No, we have not. And now I have to, after it's done, still pay for the wedding of my daughter. So, you know, I encourage any of you who are interested in a Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry t-shirt to contact me on our message board. So, Barry, now a little bit of trivia for you. Happened to catch this the other day, giving credit where it's due. Sirius Satellite Radio. I was listening to the, I guess it was the rock channel. I wasn't listening to one of the 70s or 80s channels. Barry, little trivia for you. Do you know which Aerosmith song the idea for the song came from a Mel Brooks movie?
Aerosmith, which was my son's favorite rock band on his own, one that I had zero influence in. It was his first favorite rock band that I had no hand or no part of, which kind of got me into Aerosmith. Doing a quick deduction on the songs that I know, I'm going to say Walk This Way.
And you know which movie it was?
Young Frankenstein.
And you listened to the same thing, didn't you, you son of a bitch?
I did not. It's the power of deduction, because there's that great line where he goes, "Walk this way." And that's it, right?
That's exactly it. There's a great story that apparently Joe Perry and Tom Hamilton went to the movies very early in their career, and they saw Young Frankenstein with, of course, the great line by Marty Feldman. Yeah, walk this way. No, walk this way. And they came back and they went up to Stephen Perry and they said, "Okay, we've got the title for your song. You've got to title the song Walk This Way." And Stephen Perry said, "What do you mean I got a title? I haven't even written the damn song yet." And they said, "We don't care. You have to, that's your title for the song." So Stephen Perry basically wrote the song around that title, which I thought was a great story. So hilarious.
Yeah, if I can just do a small correction right there. Stephen Tyler or
Tyler.
Joe Perry, you've married them.
Of course,
and
apparently
I am Stephen Perry, right?
I was not 100% correct on that one.
Yeah, that's good. Mel Brooks, how old is Mel Brooks at this point?
He's got to be 90s at this point.
Easy. And Carl Reiner is another one that's also alive. That's got to be in his 90s at this point. Mel Brooks is, what a treasure. I don't think he's got any more movies coming out. I'm imagining at his age, he's probably done. But, you know, you go back into his and really, were there funnier movies, you know, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, that whole early 70s kind of deal? I think he was like the leader of comedy at that point.
Those two movies came out in the same year.
Seriously?
Yeah, that's just crazy. I mean, like, talk about a back-to-back, you know, just a blockbuster of great comedy films. Yeah, those two films were absolutely amazing, and films that probably could not be made today, needless to say.
Yeah.
So, all right. Now, Barry, it is time for the return of our top five. It's time for our top five Michael Douglas films as recommended by Mr. Barry Rose. Barry?
I got to give credit. I think it came from one of our Facebook group, a guy named Joe Christie.
Okay.
Killer Joe Christie.
Joe Christie, thank you for the idea. We want to give credit to the people that gave us the idea. Have I made my point with that one, Barry?
I think you have. I think the point is loud and clear at this point, yes.
Barry, your number five Michael Douglas movie of all time.
And I'm a big Michael Douglas fan. I wouldn't say anything current, but he's got a group there of probably 7 to 10 movies, which, you know, for our purposes, there will be 10 movies, no doubt, five on each side. But that's a pretty impressive resume. And these are what I like to call watchable movies. These are the kind of movies that I have no problem sitting down. My number five is Fatal Attraction, 1987. When Fatal Attraction came out, I remember it was definitely in the summer. I think it was the late summer. I remember exactly where I saw it. I saw it at the Omni in Miami. at a movie theater there, and it was a very good movie, and I think it was a little frightening to anybody that was thinking of possibly cheating on a spouse. You know, it was interesting as well because there was something I didn't grasp at the time, which certainly in later years you get, but, you know, he was married to this beautiful woman. What was her name? Ann Archer. Ann Archer. She was lovely. And he cheated with Glenn Close, who, you know, whatever, was not quite as lovely as Ann Archer on a physical level. And, you know, it just, he wound up having an affair with Glenn Close. Turns out she's mentally unstable and starts to really do a lot of things, contacting the family. She boils the rabbit. Remember, she kills the rabbit. There's a great climax in the movie that takes place. But this was kind of a scary movie because this was one of those that, yeah, okay, this shit could really happen. You know, this was like a horror movie where you go, wait a minute, this isn't like zombies coming out of the earth. This is something that, you know, you get involved with the wrong person and you don't know them and they're psycho. So I really enjoyed this movie. This was a huge hit that this year as well, too. And Michael Douglas played it up extremely well. He's, you know, he's such a good actor. It just did such a great job. And Glenn Close too is somebody also that is a tremendous actress, and she had been around for several years, but this was the movie that kind of made her. And she was in a movie a year or two earlier called Jagged Edge with really one of my favorites, Jeff Bridges. And, she plays a lawyer in this movie, which I just thought was fantastic, but this made Glenn Close kind of a household name at that point. And if I'm correct, they even made the cover of People magazine based off of this movie. So, this is my number five. I love it. I'll still watch it. And it's still a little scary to me when I watch this on TV.
Yeah. You're right. Every married man that watched this movie immediately knew. I would have to say the cases of adultery went way down when this movie was made, because, you know, when they had the Hassenpfeffer for dinner that night because the pet rabbit was being boiled. Yeah, she was one scary ass chick in this movie. And, you know, she ended up not winning the Academy Award for this performance, which quite frankly, she should have. She won it next year, the year after that. And I'm trying to remember, Barry, what was the name of the movie where she played? It was like a Victorian aged movie, and she won the Academy Award.
Dangerous
Liaison, yes. And she won for that, but everyone kind of realized that she should have got it for Fatal Attraction, because she was absolutely amazing in that. So yeah, crazy.
Did you ever see her appearances on David Letterman?
I did not.
So when David, and I used to love David Letterman back in the 80s, you know, the 90s to me were different, but in the 80s, David Letterman was the end all be all to me. And if I wasn't watching, I was recording it and then watching it. But he used to have her on. He was in love with her. And he used to say this to her, and I don't know how she didn't get offended, but he would go, "You have a beautiful forehead. I really like your forehead," which is, it's an odd thing to say to a woman, obviously, because she had kind of a larger forehead. But I guess she always took it in stride because she was on the show many times.
We could do top five David Letterman guests ever, because I have to tell you, every David Letterman show where Vince McMahon was on there was absolute money in the bank. I mean, I think we've referenced it before. The night where I think it was Bob Costas was at one hospital and Vince was at another hospital, and they were waiting to see, it was New Year's Eve. They're waiting to see who was going to be the official late night baby for that year. And Vince is calling it like a play by play guy at a wrestling match. It was absolutely hilarious if you've never seen it. My number five, Barry, is the movie that made Sharon Stone's leg cross famous. I am going Basic Instinct from 1992 with Michael Douglas and Sharon Stone. Michael Douglas plays a detective investigating a murder. Sharon Stone is a woman that may or may not have had something to do with it, Barry, but everybody remembers that scene where Sharon Stone crosses the old legs in front of the police officers there. And Wayne Knight from Seinfeld, Newman, he was one of the detectives, and he's sitting there smoking the cigarette, and she crosses the legs, gives him the full beef shot. Basic Instinct. What a great movie, Barry.
Yeah. And I think she really did do the beef shot in this as well. If I'm correct, I think it was legit. That Basic Instinct is a fantastic movie. From start to finish too. And it was one of those movies, and Sharon Stone I guess in real, and I could bring up where she snubbed me once.
No, not another one.
Yeah. Especially Sharon Stone snubbed me too. But she was drop dead gorgeous. She was a really good actress, but I get the feeling like apparently she's highly intelligent. She's got like an IQ of like 140, and she's a member of Mensa. But you get the feeling like she's a real horse's ass in real life. That's what I've always gotten, which to me, I think she kind of shot herself in the foot, because I think she was on track and could have and should have been one of the bigger movie stars of that generation. And instead, she made a couple of big movies and then kind of petered out, if I can use that word.
I think that's the first time the word petered has ever been used on this show.
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, this is a really good movie too. And who's the other female? Is it Jean Triplehorn?
Correct.
Yeah, Jean, I really liked her as well. I have a connection to her, which I won't bring up, but I actually like Jean Triplehorn a lot too. And that was somebody I thought was going to have a bigger career in Hollywood. She made that horrible movie with Kevin Costner, Waterworld, which really, I guess it's not horrible. It's just not that good. But she was, I thought she was a fine actress as well. So I like Basic Instinct a lot. If you hadn't taken that, I probably would have taken that on my list also.
Yeah. Okay. Barry, number four.
Number four, The China Syndrome. 1979's The China Syndrome, also starring Jane Fonda and Jack Lemmon. And this is a movie where Jane Fonda plays a news reporter. Michael Douglas is her cameraman. And unintentionally, they're witness to an incident of an emergency corps shutdown in a nuclear power plant in California. And they're able to prevent some sort of catastrophe from happening. But the plant supervisor, who is played by the great Jack Lemmon, what a great actor Jack Lemmon was, he starts to suspect that the plant's in violation of safety standards. This is such a cool movie, too. And this is one of those movies I think I saw as a kid, and I was like, yeah, this is like an adult movie. It was kind of, it wasn't made for somebody who was 15 years old, which I think I was at the time when the movie came out. And then I watched it again in years later, and I was like, man, this is a quality movie. Michael Douglas, solid. Jane Fonda, a very polarizing figure for a lot of reasons, very solid. But Jack Lemmon, money in the bank on this one, too. And this was a kind of a big movie, too. It was 23rd for the year and made almost $36 million. And that's got to be all adults going to see that. So have you ever seen China Syndrome?
I have. It's an amazing film and caused some amazing reactions around not only in this country, but around the world, because it really opened people's eyes to the dangers of a nuclear meltdown and nuclear power plants. And, this and I remember movies like Silkwood with Meryl Streep was another great movie where it was talking about people exposing the threat of nuclear waste and nuclear matter. And, of course, this movie also inspired one of the all-time classic Saturday Night Live skits where Dan Aykroyd as President Jimmy Carter goes to Three Mile Island to check out the nuclear power plant. And just you remember that skit, Barry?
Oh, yeah.
Where he becomes a supersized president and he ends up marrying the cleaning lady, Garrett Morris, who's also supersized. Yeah, that was a great skit. No, it's a great movie, though.
Yeah, definitely. It's a great movie, too.
So, okay, my number four, I am going to Michael Douglas's Academy Award winning role. I quote, "Thank you. I am not the destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. And greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much." Greed, that one speech gave Michael Douglas the Academy Award for Wall Street, Barry. Gordon Gekko and those great-looking late 80s suits that he wore. He was the ultimate heel in this movie, along with him and Charlie Sheen as his young apprentice that sort of caught up in all the inner workings of his malfeasance, as they say. But what a great heel character Gordon Gekko was in Wall Street.
Yeah, it's another great movie, too. And I'm going to just say that going forward, every time Michael Douglas is brought up, much like, and we haven't mentioned this too, and somebody actually did mention this, and I do not remember this person's name, but somebody mentioned that, hey, where's Jumbo Shiruda and Patrick Swayze? Yes, it's been several weeks, but maybe Michael Douglas will start to make the rotation. He's great in this movie. He's great in this movie. Could this movie have been made with anybody else? I don't know. You know, and I'm sure it could have, but at the same time, this seems like a natural role for him. And I'll tell you, this is such a good movie. I'll tell you who really stole the movie for me is Martin Sheen. And Martin Sheen playing the father of Charlie Sheen, which, you know, obviously excellent typecasting on that one, too.
Was not a bit of a stretch there at all.
No stretch, too. He's got a great line that I use to this day, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't remember word for word. But I say this to my son, and I'll say, when you look in the mirror, you're going to wake up to yourself every day. And I know that I'm butchering exactly what he said. I don't remember word for word. But basically, girlfriends will come and go. People in your life. In your life will come and go, but when you look in the mirror, that's the face you're going to see. You're going to be with you for the rest of your life. You've got to be able to answer to yourself for your choices and your decisions. And I just thought that's such a powerful life lesson, especially as you're raising children. So, which is hard to believe that you and I are actually parents sometimes based off the shit that we say. yeah, right? I was going to say, who would have thought, right? But fantastic movie. Another one, Jeff, that had you not chosen it, it probably would have wound up on my list as well.
Okay, you're number three, Barry.
My number three is Star Chamber. Star Chamber came out in 1983, and I will quickly tell you a little story about Star Chamber. I was dating a girl in 83 who was way too good for me on every single level, and she really wanted to see the movie Mr. Mom. And I said, yeah, I'll go see Mr. Mom with you. Well, as it turned out, it was either Friday or Saturday night. My group of friends and I all went out to see Mr. Mom, and I had to tell her the next day that I did not see Mr. Mom, but I saw the movie Star Chamber. And of course, I hadn't seen it, so she starts quizzing me on what the movie's about. And to be honest, I had done zero research. I had no idea what the fucking movie's about, and I was making it up. A year later, we had already broken up, or I should say she had broken up with me at this point. I'm watching Star Chamber on cable, and it was fantastic. And Mr. Mom was a huge hit in 1983, but I don't know. If you go back and you watch it, I'm not quite sure it's aged. I'll probably catch some heat for that. I'm not quite sure that Mr. Mom has aged extremely well. Michael Keaton's great. The movie, it's like a TV movie almost. That being said, Star Chamber was great. And Star Chamber really wasn't a hit when it came out. It came in 97th for the year as far as making money, behind such notable classics as Chained Heat, The Sting Part 2, and Private School. So, right, so should really
Sting
tell
Part
you,
2, what a piece of crap that movie
what
was.
What a piece of shit it was. Like, so to tell you that people did not flock to see The Star Chamber was, I guess, a testament that Michael Douglas hadn't hit the big time yet. And he was really about a year or so away from hitting the big time. But this is a great movie. And basically, Michael, and I mention this to my son all the time, that I wonder if the Star Chamber really exists, and if it doesn't, it should exist. But basically, Michael Douglas plays a judge, and he's kind of just like ticked off at the failures of the legal system because he's seeing hardened criminals go free on technicalities, whether it's like the Miranda rights or something, guys that you know are guilty, but they're getting off on a technicality. And as it turns out, the great Hal Holbrook, really one of the best actors, I think, of his generation, plays another judge, and he introduces Michael Douglas to the Star Chamber, which is really a group of judges who are rogue judges that make the decision on when guys get off on a technicality. They almost do a thumbs up, thumbs down kind of scenario on it. So it's kind of like guilty or not guilty. And then they will actually hire a hitman to go out and kill the offender. So the premise is great. Of course, there's a twist at the end where they've deemed these a couple of guys guilty, and it turns out they're not. And then Michael Douglas got to try to stop the assassin from killing them. And it's just such a good movie. And I think our friend Randy Rusk, Randy, who has been to a couple of fan fests, so we know Randy extremely well. But he loves this movie, and he and I were actually talking about it at the last Fan Fest. So, have you ever seen Star Chamber?
I have not. That's one of the
being somebody, you're so tied up into the court system too. I'd be curious to see what you thought about it.
Well, and as you were describing the plot, you know what it reminded me of is the Clint Eastwood movie Magnum Force, where it was the cops that were taking out the guys that had gotten off on a technicality. So it's kind of a similarity there with the cops taking out the bad guys or the judges.
And it's kind of got a Dexter type of quality too. I mean, Dexter was a guy that worked for the police department, but basically, you know, at least the beginning of the show, the first few seasons, Dexter was only going for people that he knew were guilty of something, crimes against humanity. So, and then it definitely changed. So yeah, it's a great premise. And there's something with this Dark Chamber. It's based off of something from France or Europe somewhere. But there's actual meaning to the name, the Star Chamber as well, which I'm not aware of what that is.
Okay. My number three film movie, I had a chance to rewatch about a week ago. It comes from 1989, stars Michael Douglas and Andy Garcia. It's called Black Rain. Michael Douglas and Andy Garcia play two cops who have to extradite a known Yakuza member back to Japan. And just the look of a film is this, the look of this film is so amazing because it's like, it's almost like a 1989 noir film because there's so much the way the lighting plays into this film. Yep. And what happens is the Yakuza guy, through an error by Michael Douglas, ends up escaping, and Michael Douglas makes it his mission while he's in Japan to go and try to hunt the guy down. Of course, the Japanese officials are not happy with Michael Douglas, dare I say, using some New York City cop-like methods. Shout out to our friend Richard Dawson, who certainly doesn't use those methods, I'm absolutely positive. But one of the great stories about this movie, as I was doing a little bit of research on it, is the two Japanese actors that are in this film are Ken Takakura and Yusuke Matsuda. And what I found interesting is that Matsuda plays the heel, where Takakura plays the cop. And in the Japanese films that these guys had been stars of for years, the roles were reversed. Takakura usually played the bad guy, and Matsuda usually played the good guy. So to Japanese fans that watch this film, it was a complete role reversal for those two. Also, what was interesting was basically Matsuda, who again plays the heel character of Sato, was dying at the time this movie was being made, and he knew that he was dying, and this movie to him and his family was his legacy, that he wanted to be there to finish this film. So as some sort of legacy to his family and his fans, he wanted to stay healthy as long as he could just so he could finish this film. And it's it's not the greatest movie of all time. It's a really solid police action drama. It's got some good plot twist. But this film is really a legacy, not only to Michael Douglas, but to Yusuke Matsuda, who died soon after the film was done, Barry.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I knew one of the guys was dying during, and he died as soon as the movie was, I don't think it was, he was gone by the time the movie was released, right?
I believe so, yeah. But he does a great job playing the heel.
Oh, he does. But the whole movie is, it's good too. And you're right too. This is a movie, this one has got a lot of style to it. And you're right about the film noir. There's a lot of lights reflecting in puddles of water. And there's beautiful visuals all the way throughout. And it's a great look, I think, at the culture of Japan. Something in, 89 or so, the late 80s, that maybe we weren't seeing a lot of. So I think this is just another stellar movie. Spoiler alert, it's been 29 years, but Andy Garcia, when he dies, I was like, motherfucker, you feel it. It's a powerful scene. So excellent movie. And what I like, I think, was this Adrian Lyne? Who did this movie? Who directed this movie, Jeff? I'll stall. I'll sing a song everybody wants to hear. I'll sing She's
Ridley
Like the Wind. Ridley Scott. Adrian Lyne, I think, is the guy who actually did Fatal Attraction then. So Ridley Scott's known for doing movies that are visual with a lot of style. So, yeah, another excellent movie, though, 100%.
Absolutely. Okay, you're number two, Barry.
My number two is tough, and I'll tell you why, because my number one and my number two are almost interchangeable. And I, you asked me today, this is number two, in 3 weeks it might be number one. I don't know. But this movie actually had a huge impact on me, 1984's Romancing the Stone. And this movie is, it's Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas. Kathleen Turner plays a romance writer. Remember when romance novels were all the rage some 30, 35 years ago?
She plays a romance writer. My mom, I think, bought 3/4 of them, yes.
It was what a huge industry. I don't know if it still exists. You know, I never hear about it, but I remember, you know, back in the day, that was like a big deal. And there were these series, they would put out like 5 books a year and sometimes even more of just these romance novels with the same characters. Well, she's a writer and she's a very boring person in real life, but her imagination creates all this. Well, it turns out her sister has been kidnapped and her brother-in-law has been killed. Because they had some sort of map to a treasure. And as it turns out, that map has been mailed to Kathleen Turner, and she has to bring the map to Cartagena, Colombia, in exchange for her sister who has been kidnapped. So she gets there, she gets on the wrong bus, she winds up in the jungle, and Michael Douglas is kind of a mercenary who has got to take her to her destination to be able to save her sister. And the movie is really kind of about the relationship between Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner, but it's super cool as they're going through the jungle, and it's a lot of fun. It's directed by Robert Zemeckis, Back to the Future, Forrest Gump, Castaway, Used Cars, so you've got a solid director. This is kind of the movie that jump-started Michael Douglas's career. He had been, if not a leading man, he had been right there bubbling. But this movie was a big movie for the year. Critics loved it. It's considered, which, you know, might seem odd, considered one of the best films of 1984. And it was compared to Raiders of the Lost Ark. So it's kind of an adventure movie as they're going through the jungles. Time magazine actually called the film a Raiders ripoff. But at the same time, I could see similarities. I don't really see that 100% with that. Here's the interesting part, too. Studio insiders expected this movie to flop to the point that a rough cut of the film, producers of the then underdevelopment Cocoon, they were filming Cocoon when this movie was being developed, they fired Robert Zemeckis, thinking that this was going to be such a failure. They fired Zemeckis off Cocoon and brought in Ron Howard. The film became a surprise hit. It was their 20th Century Fox biggest hit of 84, and Robert Zemeckis actually said this movie is the movie that allowed him to make Back to the Future, which, you know, it's an iconic film at this point. So I love Romancing the Stone, and I've got it on my DVR, and it's one of those that's in my rotation. I'll watch it once every couple of months, maybe once every 2 or 3 months. And from start to finish, just such a fun movie. And Kathleen Turner is somebody that I don't think I've ever really liked her in much else. She's slightly abrasive at times, but I love her in this movie. She completely works in this movie, and Michael Douglas is just so cool. There's a great scene where they discover a... Have you ever seen the movie?
Oh, yeah, many times.
Yeah, they're sitting in a plane in the middle of Colombia, and it was a drug-running plane, and they're sitting in there, and there's, I guess, bales upon bales of marijuana, and they decide to spend the night, and he's lighting up the weed, the bales, and just toking it, and he finds an old Rolling Stone magazine, and he goes, fuck, the Doobie Brothers broke up? When did this happen, you know? I just think that's such a great scene. So I love this movie. This is one of those movies, I talk about it, but when I first moved to New York, this was one of the first movies I think I saw, like in the first couple of months I was there. And, it just is such an escape being in a New York movie theater and seeing this on a big screen that even now, 35 years later, has just left in this impression on me. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great fun movie. A couple things that I'm reminded of. Kathleen Turner also starred with Michael Douglas in the sequel, Jewel of the Nile, which was which was good, but not quite as good as Romancing the Stone. Kathleen Turner before, in the early part of the 80s, of course, made the iconic, I believe it was a Brian De Palma film, Body Heat, where she was a huge sex symbol when that came out, because she was smoking hot when that came out. And, of course, I also, for some reason, suddenly flashed to remember that the John Cusack film High Fidelity, at the end of the movie, Jack Black references that the name, one of the names that his band had considered was Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is a funny line. But as you talk about this movie, Romancing the Stone, A Jewel of the Nile, the third film that this, this duo made together, Barry, slightly different. From 1989, Danny DeVito directed them in The War of the Roses. Folks, this is what is known as a extremely dark comedy. And boy, do I love my comedy jet black, because this is some dark, dark shit, Barry. As a couple who's been married, and you go back and you, there's a retrospective on how they began their life together, you know, when they met as young people, and they've, you know, had spent all this time together, and now the marriage is falling apart. And one of the members of the couple is going to get the family house, and nobody wants to move an inch, and nobody wants to budge, and the shit starts getting real, but in a very funny, funny way. That you'll find almost like The Office, you'll find yourself cringing, but it's extremely funny. I can't even stress how dark a comedy this is. The War of the Roses, Barry. Tell me if you've seen that.
Yeah, I think it's one of the darker comedies out there, almost like a Throw Mama from the Train. So I did see this movie, and I got to admit, I don't love this movie, and it's possibly too dark and too mean that when I saw it. So again, a huge fan of Romancing the Stone, Jewel of the Nile came across to me as, we'll make a sequel to try to make money off the success of the first one, but it doesn't capture the heart. This movie has no heart, War of the Roses. It is maybe the darkest comedy I've ever seen. So I have seen it. I'm just not the biggest fan of the movie. I think part of it was too, something for me with films, it's character development. And I love fleshed out characters, but I have to like a character or relate to a character. And I don't think I could like anybody in this movie, or relate to anybody in this movie, which is probably why I didn't love the movie too much.
All right. So you're number one.
My number one is, and again, this would be kind of a revolving deal with number two, but Falling Down. 1993's Falling Down to me is, it's a work of art. And I don't think this movie gets the credit that maybe it should get. Michael Douglas, I think it's his best performance that he's ever given in a film. But I also thought the movie from start to finish, and for some people, it's super depressing, this movie. And that's the biggest criticism I've heard of the movie. I don't necessarily see it as super depressing. There's a sadness to it based off of the story. Basically, Michael Douglas plays a character named William Foster, and he's divorced. He's an unemployed former defense engineer. And it basically centers on the fact that he's trying to get to his daughter's birthday party, which is being held at the house of his ex-wife or his estranged wife. And it's another adventure movie where he's got to go from point A to point B, and everything that takes place as he gets there. And he goes through a lot. He's got a lot of encounters. He's interacting with a lot of violent people, but he's dealing, and he's got these real observations about life in general, the economy, politics, commercialism, poverty. It's a real eye-opener in a lot of different ways. And to me, his acting is, I think the story is fantastic, but his acting, I can't see anybody else doing this. And partly I think because it's such a strong role This is a Michael Douglas movie. It's, you know, there's other characters that come and go, and I think Robert Duvall is also great in this movie for the role that he's playing. But this is Michael Douglas. This is almost a one man movie, and it's Michael Douglas from point A to point B, and everything that takes place in between. This movie was directed by Joel Schumacher. Joel Schumacher, St. Elmo's Fire, Flatliners, The Lost Boys. Jeff, I have a story of a celebrity who did not snub me.
What?
I'd like to share it because it's actually a sweet story. So Joel Schumacher was filming a movie in New York City, and this would have been around 2001. And he was coming into my restaurant on a daily basis. And he would come in with his assistants, which were two other guys, younger guys, and they would come in, and he was always very, very kind. He's a very gentle guy, and he would come in, and I would always get him a table in the restaurant right away. We always had a line. A lot of people had to wait in line. Joel Schumacher walked in, and I would always see them. He was always friendly and grateful for that, and he never took that for granted. And I always thought that was kind of a cool thing. So my son was born at the end of February in 2001, and I took off 2 weeks. And I came back to work in mid-March, and he was one of the, like on my first or second day back, he came in and he was, oh, where have you been? I haven't seen you. And I said, oh, you know, I said, I was 37 years old. I just had my first child, a little boy. And he said, do you have a photo? And I said, absolutely. You know, at that point, I was carrying technical actual photos in my pocket because I didn't have a cell phone. So I showed him a photo and he goes, congratulations. And he gives me a big hug. And, you know, 10 minutes later, he calls me over to his table and he goes, this is for your son. And it was a gift. And he had sent one of his assistants to go to the gift shop next door to my restaurant to buy a $200 blanket, a patch quilt blanket for my son. And I just tell you, I'm still touched. We still have the blanket to this day. And again, one of the handful of stories where a celebrity has not snubbed me and pushed me out of the way was Joel Schumacher. So at that point, I'm a Joel Schumacher fan. Of course, this movie came out way before that. This movie was 37th for the year, made almost $41 million. It was the number one movie for 2 weeks, its first 2 weeks of release, and it pushed the previous top movie, which was Groundhog Day, into second place. Just a quote from Michael Douglas's father, Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas, still alive, 211 years old now, Jeffrey.
Wow.
And Kirk, yeah, exactly, oldest human being to ever live. Kirk Douglas, still alive. And he said, he played it brilliantly. I think it is his best piece of work to date. And then he also defended the movie against critics who claimed that it glorified law-breaking. Michael's character is not the hero or newest urban icon. He is the villain and the victim. Of course, we see many elements of our society that contributed to his madness. We even pity him, but the movie never condones his actions. So, and that's a really brilliant statement, I think, on a lot of different levels right there, because that was a big deal. You know, there was certain groups in Los Angeles were picketing this movie because it glorified violence against Hispanics or Asians. I forget exactly what it was at the time, but you know, I don't think so. I think it showed somebody that was pushed to their breaking point and finally basically snapped and basically said, I'm tired of being pushed around. If you fuck with me, I will kill you. That's kind of what I saw from the movie. So I know you've seen Falling Down. I honestly think it's a brilliant movie from start to finish.
And, you know, I think one of the things you have to give credit, Michael Douglas, obviously an incredibly good looking guy, son of a bitch. But the fact that he was willing to, you know, wear the horn rim glasses, give himself a crew cut, the short sleeve and tie, what I call the Andy Sipowicz look from NYPD Blue. And to just become that character. He was absolutely brilliant in the role. There's, you know, you're absolutely right about that. And it's an amazing movie, amazing look at one man's slow disintegration and an incredible performance, Barry.
Yeah, too. And it was one that I had on my DVR. Do you know this, Jeff? I don't know if you know this. If you've got movies on your DVR and your cable box craps out, you lose all those movies.
Yeah, so yes, movies, I'm well familiar with that.
I was fucking devastated, man. So like 2 weeks ago, my cable box crapped out and I had to get a new one. And all the movies that I spent 8 or 9 years getting on my DVR, which is my Rolodex of movies that I love, I lost. And I call the cable company. I'm like, come on, it's not in the fucking cloud somewhere? It's not stored? No, sorry, sir. If you're, God damn it, really? So, yeah, so I lost Falling Down. I'm going to have to get it on, I don't think it's on Netflix either because I was checking. I'm going to have to get it somewhere. Maybe even get a hard copy, a DVD copy. But what a wonderful film.
Yeah. Okay, Barry, now it's time for my number one. My number one film comes from 1997 director David Fincher, who we have discussed his work on this show before. And between the movies Seven and The Fight Club, he gave us 1997's The Game. Michael Douglas plays a very wealthy banker who starts to have the lines between real life and a game blurred. As he's trapped inside this game that he does not realize has been set up for him by his brother, played, may I say, Barry, rather unrealistically, strictly from a physical standpoint, by Sean Penn. Sean Penn and Michael Douglas look nothing alike. So I thought that was a little ridiculous. But this is a just a great sort of what I like to call a mindfuck movie, Barry, where you're sitting there and you're like the character, you're trying to discern what is real and what is part of the game. And you get trapped up. David Fincher, God, what a friggin' great director that guy is. He just has so many outstanding pieces of work. He's a filmmaker, Barry. He's not a movie maker. He's a filmmaker. And this, I think, this role really challenged Michael Douglas. I really, really love this movie, Barry.
We've praised David Fincher before numerous times. And look, Jeff, break out the t-shirt. You're 100% correct. He is a filmmaker. He does not make movies and they're not pieces of shit. When he makes a movie, that scene in The Game when Michael Douglas is falling, you remember the scene?
Oh, yeah.
The end?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a slow motion falling and he's going through, I like the glass. I don't know if it's stained glass, but he's going, it's like, you know, for so many people that could have been a throwaway. Just again, he's an artistic director and you see that in the movie. So I love this movie. And when I saw this movie in the theaters, and you think you know everything about this movie and you don't, because there's so many twists to it, and the movie is ever evolving. Just when you think you know what's happening, you don't. There's something new happening to it. And when I left the theater, I thought to myself, this is one of maybe the great movies that I've seen. Like, this was really, I don't think in hindsight, hey, this is not a movie you can watch repetitively.
No.
Sadly. And I think that's the flaw of it. It was kind of like that movie with The Usual Suspects with Kevin Spacey, the now shamed Kevin Spacey, who is Kaiser Soze, that if you understand the big reveal, there's so much emphasis on the big reveal, it takes away from repetitive viewings. Remember the movie The Crying Game?
Oh, yes. Big reveal at that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's a very good movie, The Crying Game, but because all this emphasis, and that was a lot of the advertising of these movies, the emphasis is placed on the big reveal. Well, at that point, how many times can I watch the movie if that's what the movie's about? I can't. So I just, in knowing what this movie was about, I think I've seen it twice since. Because visually it's great, and there are some shit that you forget about. But again, Michael Douglas, spectacular. Sean Penn, you want to punch him in the face, but very good in the movie. But a lot of the little ancillary characters that pop up throughout this movie are really good. So if you've never seen The Game, and I'm not going to give away too much. So again, spoiler, it's 21 years. But at the same time, if you've never seen it, this is worth a viewing to check it out, because just when you think you know it, you don't know it. You don't know this movie. It's an excellent movie.
A couple of really great character actors that we probably should have mentioned during our show by character actors. James Rebhorn. Who's one of those guys, you see him and you go, and yep. Armin Mueller-Stahl, who's a guy. Oh, my
Jeff,
God.
Jeff, I didn't even tell you about this. Yep. I watched entire, from start to finish, Eastern Promises.
Oh, what a great movie. And he's fantastic.
Armin Mueller-Stahl is in the movie. Yeah. So what a boy, that's a great movie too. So here's the thing. We had talked about, and you're right about that scene when that takes place in the bathhouse, which I think that was our best fight scene or something.
Yes.
I forget. Yeah. We did a long, that's a fucking killer scene. That whole movie is really good though. Yeah. Eastern Promises. Armin Mueller-Stahl, this guy's money too. This guy, he's just on a screen and the movie's better if he's on the screen.
He is the film's version of Walter in The Ring, Barry.
He's Walter. They're both Austrian, aren't they?
I think they are. So, yeah. All right, folks, as we begin to wrap up here, I have a special reveal for those fans of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Next week, Barry, we're gonna let them know. We're gonna give a little tease. Next week, it's Unsolved Mysteries Part 2. Boom! Barry, you ready for that?
Jeff, if I was any more excited, I would be the proverbial, as I've referenced, 12-year-old schoolgirl jumping up and down off my couch right now. But that's how excited I am for the
And again, we really don't want to get that mental picture, I have to tell you. So, folks, I will encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the great Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Until next week, we've got some mysteries for you.